Hi everybody, I'm Sheldon Fenner, an alcoholic. I was sitting at home thinking about coming to Grand Cayman for a roundup. And I was thinking to myself, you know, when I was drinking and I was in my alcoholic, you know, I had this depressive stage. I don't know if any of you guys had any depressive stages. And I'm thinking about how much my life is just miserable and just horrible and I just want to kill myself. And I'm thinking, if I had lived in Grand Cayman, right, I wouldn't have been an alcoholic. I don't know how it would, I'm sitting at home thinking, I don't know how it would be possible to be an alcoholic living in Grand Cayman. And then I got here. And I don't know why this roundup's not 10 times the size it is. I don't know how it's possible to live in Grand Cayman and not be an alcoholic, to be honest, but... You guys are the tough people. You guys are the ones that drank it all, survived, and are now sober. And that's beautiful. I'd like to thank you guys very much for inviting me out here, for the hospitality of the folks that I've met. I've been here since last Monday, and some of you guys I've gotten to meet, and the hospitality has been fantastic. Really very, very cool. Tell you a little bit about me, because it's my favorite subject. Now, hopefully you guys won't be pained too much by me talking about me for the next hour. But I was born in England. I was born in a city called Leeds, about 200 miles straight north of London. My accent that you hear is because I've lived in America for 32 years, and over the years it's kind of drifted away. I think it's because I am a chameleon. I have the any chameleons? I have the ability to fit in any... My brother tells me it's because I have no personality of my own. I think he's probably right about that. But I was born in Leeds, and my parents are non-alcoholic, average parents. None of them need any kind of fellowship whatsoever. My dad told me that he doesn't really like to drink much. It dulls his fun. I immediately assumed that I was adopted. Because I don't understand that nonsense at all. It's just ridiculous, right? Just ridiculous. But my dad and mom divorced when I was very young. I was 2 years old when my dad left. And growing up was miserable. I hated my childhood. In fact, if you'd have asked me while I was drinking and shortly after I got here why I drank the way that I drank, I would have told you it was because of the way that I was raised. And if you were raised the way that I was raised, you would have drank too, right? You know what the worst thing is about my childhood? The absolute worst? It happened to me. If it would have happened to you, I would have told you to get over it, punky. Right? I mean, seriously, right? There's speakers here this weekend that had the type of childhood stark contrast to mine. There are people in and out of AA, people who are not alcoholic, people who've never drank to excess, that had the kind of childhood that you read about. You know, they're abused and they're beaten with cords and emotionally and sexually and physically abused. None of that happened to me. None of that happened to me. But when things happen to me, they're somehow painfully worse. When my dad left, we moved from a nice middle-class neighborhood. I was born into a Jewish home. I'll probably talk more about that later, but I was born into a Jewish home, and when my dad left, we moved from this nice middle-class Jewish neighborhood to Section 8 housing, and we became a welfare family. Dad disappeared. Mom was left with two kids, and she did the best she could, but she struggled to raise us in government-subsidized housing in a council neighborhood in the north of Leeds. And she was very cranky. Was my mom. You know, at the time, I didn't realize this, but looking back, you can imagine how difficult it was for her to raise us boys, and that would make anybody cranky. I had no appreciation for that, though, when I was a kid. I just thought that she was a... You know. I just figured that she was rotten. And my brother, he's 2 years older than me, he decided that he was now going to be the man of the house. And he wasn't equipped for that, and he was a little bit violent, not horribly violent, but I'm not very tough. My favorite fighting mood is falling down crying, right? So he didn't have to be very violent, but he was a little violent, and I hated him and I hated my mom, and I hated my childhood, and I'm awkward, and I'm short, and I'm fat, and I live in this non-Jewish neighborhood, and I come from this Jewish neighborhood, and in England, a lot of anti-Semitism, not, my experience in America is radically different than my experience in England, a lot of anti-Semitism in England, and it was very, I get in fights a lot, and I hated me, and I hated you. And I'll never forget my first drink. I was 9 years old. Now, the fact that I remember my first drink does not make me alcoholic. It's interesting. I like a lot of things. One of the things I really like is peanut M&Ms. Right? I just love them, right? The chocolatey, rainbow-colored, crunchy peanuts. I love them. I don't remember my first bag. It stands to reason that there was M&M bag number one, but it doesn't come to mind. But I remember my first drink. I was 9 years old, I was with a kid called Barry. Barry was 2 years older than me. Now, because he was 2 years older than me, that meant that he was instantly cool. And I would have done anything that Barry asked me to do. I'm actually quite glad he asked me to drink, or who knows what direction my life would have gone, right? But Barry asked me to drink. If any of you guys run into my sponsor, would you tell him I wore a jacket? Barry wanted to drink, and we stood in front of a liquor store, and we waited for some guy that was willing to go in and buy us a bottle of Old English apple cider, right? It's apple juice with a kick. This guy goes in the store, buys us a bottle of Old English apple cider. We take it into a wooded area behind the liquor store, and we start to drink. And Barry takes a big pull on this bottle. Hands it to me, and I take a big pull on this bottle. And I did something that day that I was going to do almost every time I drank from that day until the day I took my last drink. I puked out of my nose. Because I'm a nose puker. Right? Some of you guys are really good drinkers, aren't you? Like, you can like drink massive quantities and you keep vodka in your glove box and you're just pigs, right? And I love you guys. I'm not the big quantity guy. I'm the guy that when you drink your friend under the table, I've been there for a while. Right? Welcome to Under the Table. It's nice and comfortable down here. I'm glad you could make it. It's been lonely until you got here, right? I'm just like, I'm not this massive quantity guy. Really what I am is I'm the pee on the couch and hit on your mom kind of guy. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we are sometimes dangerously and disgustingly antisocial. And I am not very dangerous. I'm disgusting. I'm just a mess. I have four or five drinks of booze, and I'm spilling things, and I'm knocking things over, and I'm just a disaster on the outside. But on the inside, something magical happens to me. Something inexplicably wonderful. Something that is just, it's like this, right? I'm this short, fat, ugly guy, big nose, Jewish, from a broken home, don't like me, don't like you, very uncomfortable, very just, the world, I don't even know where I got this from, but it feels like the world is some kind of a test that you have to get through. And if you can survive the test of life here on earth, your rewards will be given to you later. And I'm not a very good test taker. Right? And it just sucks, and I'm miserable, and I don't like it, and I take this Old English apple cider, and I hold enough of it down for it to do its magic, and nothing really happened. But it felt like maybe I grew a couple inches, felt like I lost a few pounds, felt like I got this alcoholic instant nose job, felt like my parents got remarried, felt like my foreskin grew back. I'm properly ashamed of that joke. I just want to make sure that you're listening. I just want to make sure that you're paying attention. But what really happened was all this angst, all this upset, all this frustration inside of me just started to melt away and disappear. And for the first time in my life at 9 years old, I felt like I could breathe. For the first time in my life at 9 years old, I felt like I found the answer to life. For the first time in my life, at 9 years old, I thought I could survive this life thing. And I made a decision at 9 years old that I was going to drink as often as I could, as much as I could, from that day until the day that I died. Now, when you live with my mom, in my mom's house with her rules, that doesn't mean I became a daily drinker at 9 years old. I wanted to be, but I wasn't able to be. I probably drank twice more that year, three or four times when I was 10 or 11, 12. By the time I was 13 years old, I was drinking something, taking something, doing something every single day. By the time I was 16 years old, I moved at 16 years old from England to California, and I was scared to death. Because I didn't know if they drank in California. Right? It's like wondering if they drink in Grand Cayman, right? Is Grand Cayman a dry island? I'm just not sure. Right? I get to California, and very, very quickly, I found my own people. My mom says that, Sheldon, you'll always, water finds its own level, and so will you. And I get to California, and very quickly, the party is on. The party is on. I'm drinking every day, and I love it. I love everything about it. You know, it's funny. I heard a guy from the podium say one time, and it was a misquote out of the big book. I understand why he said it. It was kind of a misquote out of our book. But he said that his best day drinking, his finest day drinking, was not as good as his worst day in AA. And I thought, what are you drinking? Because if it sucked that bad, why would you keep doing it? Why would you trade all your self-worth, all your self-esteem, all of the things inside you that are good? Why would you do that for something so terrible? It was magical. Now, I'm an alcoholic. I have one disease, the disease of alcoholism, but I am a pig, and I will do anything I can get my hands on. And I have a picture in my mind of this one particular event that kind of describes alcoholism for me when the booze is working. I'm at the Shoreline Amphitheater. It's a little concert venue outside of San Francisco in Mountain View. And the Grateful Dead are playing. And I'm at the top of this amphitheater, and the Dead and the boys are on the stage. This is probably in like 87, 88. I'm on four hits of windowpane, and I've drank just about everything I could get in my gullet. And the band starts to play, and it's kind of misty and murky, and there's lightning in the background. It's not raining, and then Bob Weir yells out, "It looks like rain," and I tell you, I am having a spiritual experience, the likes of which no 12-step call has ever given me. I mean, I'm just on fire for life, right? And when it was doing that for me, I would pay any price, and I did. I paid every price. I ruined the relationship with my mom and the relationship with my dad. I threw away every great job opportunity that I had. I was a fairground pitchman selling Ginsu knives at state and county fairs. But wait, there's more. See? Right? And because of a weird set of circumstances, I ended up on QVC. I ended up a spokesperson of QVC in the Home Shopping Network. I was 23 years old, and I'm like Wilson. I have arrived. I have arrived. It's an amazing job for a young kid, but I can't quit drinking. You would think that if I was drinking to try and make myself somehow feel a little better about my life or have a little fun or whatever, you would think that this job came along and it would be the answer to my problems and I'd be able to keep it under control. But that's not what happened. I started to drink more and I started to do more drugs, and they eventually fired me from that job. Now I know why they fired me, because we always know. There was an English guy that was working there, and he didn't like Jews. That's not what they said. What they said on the form when they fired me was they said that they couldn't have an alcoholic crack addict as their national spokesperson, which I thought was a little bit of an overreaction, to be honest. You know, I mean, I thought we could have worked around that. But they weren't very happy with me, and I lost that job, and I got another job, and I lost that job, and I got another job, and I lost that job. And I'm in Southern California, and I'm 25 years old, and I feel like my life's over. I feel like I've drank myself into a place where I have no relationships worthwhile in my life. I am not very attractive at my best, right? You put me where I was at 25 years old, and I hadn't had a girlfriend for a while. My parents were mad at me. I wasn't talking to my dad. I was alive in the driveway of my dad's house, but I wasn't actually allowed in the house. My mom lived in Chicago, and she'd take my calls sometimes. But unfortunately for her, most of those calls at some point came to the conversation of, "Mom, can you send me some money?" and I put so much stress on her marriage with her second husband, my stepdad, that she wasn't really taking my calls. Most of the friends that I had one friend left, and most of my other friends, they turned their back on me because I say things that are inappropriate, and I take things that aren't mine, and I embarrass them in their places of work and in front of their families, and I'm just not a fun guy to be around. And so I'm kind of shut off from everybody, and I'm starting to get depressed, and I can barely get a job, and if I get a job, I lose it very quickly, and I'm getting to this kind of sad, depressed, crying state of my alcoholism. And I think, you know, boy, maybe I should get sober. I don't know what I should do. And my one friend that I have left takes me into his home. There's him and his wife and their son. Their son at the time was probably 13 years old. Great kid. This is in Laguna Beach, California. And in Laguna Beach, California, Laguna High has a surf team at the high school. This kid is captain of his grade of the surf team. He's a little stud dude. Great little kid. They bring me into their home. They bring the wolf into their home with this kid. Now, my buddy's not one of us, so he likes to party a little bit. This is kind of how I got to know him, through the party scene. And he brings me into his home, and one night he comes home from work, and I'm staying in their spare bedroom, and he's got with him a 12-pack of beer and some other stuff. And we start to drink, and we start to do the other stuff, and unlike me, after a couple hours, he says it's bedtime. And he takes the rest of the six pack, a 12 pack. He puts it in the fridge. Takes the other stuff that he bought, puts it in his room, puts it away, like we're gonna do it tomorrow. I know tomorrow never comes, right? I mean, it's a ridiculous proposition. But he does that, and I go in the room, and I'm laying in my bed, and I can't sleep. How can you sleep? My head's just telling me there's more. You can't sleep. I can't sleep. He goes to work the next morning. I get up. I go to the fridge. I steal the beer, go to his room, steal the other stuff, and I do it all up. And he comes home that night, and he says, "Did you take my beer?" I said, "No. I think it was your son." "Oh, come on. Did I waste this a PTA meeting?" "Oh, believe it or not, I have lied to people about my drinking and stolen to keep the party going, right?" You don't do that in Grand Cayman, do you?" "No, not here, right?" So he kicks me out of his house. I have nowhere to go. I call my dad. My dad sets me up in a hotel. He says, "I'll put you in a hotel for one night. We'll figure this out in the morning. You can't come here." I check into that hotel with my dad's credit card. And the first thing I do is I go to the bar and I drink up dad's credit card. And the next morning I know I'm in trouble. I know he's going to get that bill. I'm going to have done it to him one more time. I've just lost my last friend. I'm about to burn my dad, or I've already burned him, but he's about to find out that I burned him one more time. And I know I'm in trouble. So I do the one thing I swore I would never do. I go to the Yellow Pages and I look up Alcoholics Anonymous, because I don't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Our friend Scott used to say it's a level of lame that I did not even know existed. I call Alcoholics Anonymous, and this guy comes and picks me up, and he did a great, looking back, he did a classic 12-step call. He picked me up, took me to a meeting. After the meeting, he sat and talked to me for a little bit about what it should be, what I want to do, am I willing to get sober. He says to me, "Are you an alcoholic?" And I don't honestly really know what he's asking me, but I know I need help. And when people ask questions like that, you know what the answer intuitively is. You know, whatever he says, you got to say yes, right? I said, "Are you an alcoholic?" I said, "Well, yes, I believe I am." He says, "Do you want to get sober?" And I'm thinking, "No. Oh my God, that would be like, I've been forced into abstinence for a couple of 3 or 4 days at a time where I got no money, can't get no beer, you know, and I'm like, I have to like not, and but I need somewhere to sleep." So I said, "Yes." And then he asked me the greatest question on earth. He said, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" And I have no idea what he's talking about. I'm afraid. what any lengths might be, to be quite honest. But I'm going to assume any lengths is lie to him, and I'm willing to do that anyway. So I'd say, yes, I'll go to any lengths to stay sober, and he takes me to a 7-day detox facility, a county-run detox facility. Now, I walk in there, and you have to remember, although it's been a very long time since this was true for me, I still believe I'm the national spokesperson of Kenwood Appliances. I'm just waiting for QVC to call back, right? Now, it's been a long time, and boy, they're not calling, but that's the way I look at the world. And I walk into this homeless detox center, and I look around, and I can imagine why some of these people should probably be here, but not me, right? But there's been a mistake, and it'll get sorted out eventually, but I'm gonna check in this place anyway. And I stay there for 7 days, and at the end of the 7 days, they tell me that they have arranged for me to stay at a halfway house. Now, I have no idea what a halfway house is, but I have nowhere else to go. So I agree to go to this halfway house. I gotta tell you, looking back in hindsight, the humanity of this place was unbelievable. This was a very rare place. You don't find places like this very often. The guy that owned this place just wanted to help drunks. So for the first week you were there, you didn't have to pay rent, they didn't ask you for any money, nothing. But if you came in there and you started looking for a job, and you looked like you were looking for a job, second week rent, absolutely free. The third week you got a job, fourth week you started that job, you didn't owe them the month's back rent. It was gratis, provided you started work within 30 days and you were getting a paycheck so you could pay the rent. I mean, it was beautiful. You don't hear places like that. They serve food, breakfast and dinner, and you could make a sandwich for lunch. All included. Beautiful. AA members would come to meetings at night. You could smoke in these places back then. And so they'd bring cigarettes and they'd throw them in a can. And you had cigarettes to smoke and they'd bring meetings in. And if you had clothes and no money, which was my situation, they had a washer and dryer and they'd provide you with quarters. The humanity of this place was absolutely unbelievable. I stayed there for 23 or 24 days. And then I gotta tell you, and I don't know if anybody's ever stayed in a halfway house, but they asked me to do a chore. You didn't hear what I said. I mean, when I say a chore, I mean once a week they wanted me on bathroom duty. I'm not cleaning the bathroom. This gets worse. They said they wanted me home by 10 o'clock at night. I was 25 years old, former national spokesperson. What are you talking about? You want me home at 10 o'clock? You've lost your mind. Who are you to tell? I would say things like, I got here all by myself. Nobody brought me here. And they'd laugh at me like, where do you think you are? Yeah. Good for you. The only thing you could accomplish by 25 years old is you decide on your own to come to a halfway house. Well, that's a great use of your time. But I left. The 27 days, I couldn't take it anymore. I said, you people have lost your mind, and I left. And what began for me next was the worst two and a half years of my life. Because I would get drunk to get sober, to get sober, to get drunk, to get sober. I'd get to be sober for a week or 10 days maybe, and I just couldn't stand it anymore, and so I'd drink again, and I'd come back to the rooms, and I might stay sober for a day or 2 days. And I just couldn't stand it anymore, and I would drink again. Because something happens to me when I'm in a state of abstinence that doesn't happen to people that don't have alcoholism. Here's what happens. I put down the bag and the bottle, which are supposed to be my problem. I've been told that my whole life. Bosses, parents, women, police officers. I got DUIs. Everybody is telling me, Sheldon, your problem is that you drink too much, and if you would quit drinking, you would be okay. That's what I've been told all my life. It seems like from the outside looking in, my problem's drinking. But I tell you, you take my booze away from me. You separate me from the thing that makes it possible for me to breathe. And something happens inside of me that I can't even describe it. But in a state of abstinence, 4, 5, 6 days away from a drink, there is this that's just starting to happen. This emptiness, this anxiety, this I know stuff about everybody and none of it's good, right? I know what you're thinking and what you should be doing, and I know who you are, and I know what you're about, and I got your number, I dig it, you know what I mean? And I'm just uptight, and I just, oh man, and I tell you, I know something, I know something's going to take that away, and I know what it is, and I know you told me I shouldn't drink it, but I got to tell you, if this is what it means for me to be sober, I just don't know if I can do it, because it just, and so I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm not going to burn my life to the ground. Why would I? I know how I got here. I am not going to do that again. I've done it over and over again, and I am not going to do it. But I tell you what I got to do, and I got to do this, and there's nothing that can stop me. I got to have one, maybe two, right? One, maybe two, three at the most. Three at the, no more than four, right? I'm going to have one, maybe two, three at the most, no more than four. That's what I'm going to have, and I'm going to do that because I got to take the edge off. I got to have something that will allow me just to, whoo, and then we'll figure out our next move. Then we'll work it out. Then we'll be able to think. I'll be able to, but right now, I just need something. And I tell you, if that's all that was wrong with me, I'd be like the guy in the movies.
That says, you know, it's very, life is difficult. I just need to have, let me have a drink to sort
that. I'd be that guy, right? But I can't do that. I don't know why it is. The magic of one, you know, just one, maybe two, right? Three at the most. No more than four. The magic of that is that something happens to me and I don't know what it is, but all of a sudden, I'm back where I was. I did it again. I'm the I did it again guy. That's who I am. I'm Mr. I did it again. I did it again. How did this? How did this happen? How did this happen? How am I back here again, you know, with nowhere to sleep? How did this happen? How did I not show up for work again? How did this happen? Why are you mad? How did this happen? I did it again. That's how it happened. I did it again. I'm the I do it again guy. And I did it again. And I come back to A and I say, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Then you're out. This time it's different. You know, I could have worn t-shirts that said, this time it's different, right? It's like my slogan that I would carry around. I had another slogan, which is, I'm not hurting nobody but myself. That was my second slogan. You know what's funny about that slogan? I only said it to people I was hurting, right? You think about the people you said that to, right? I said it to the people I was, in tears running down my dad's face. What are you crying for, Dad? I'm not hurting anybody but myself. You know, and he's like, who am I? Right? But I, you know, this time it's different. I come back to the rooms and I want to be sober. I don't know if I want to be sober. I know that I don't want to keep drinking the way that I'm drinking, but and I'm telling people this, that something happens to me that is different and I feel uncomfortable. And so I have and they say, well, you can't have a couple of drinks, Shelby. You have this thing we call the phenomenon of craving. Well, what's that? They say, that's Sheldon. That's where if you have a couple of drinks, you know, one, maybe two, three at the most, no more than four, you have a couple of drinks, and then you will drink against your will. Oh, I don't know about that. That sounds to me like I go into a bar, order a bottle of scotch. Barkeep, leave it right here. And I pour myself one, two, three, by the third or fourth drink, the bottle of scotch grows arms and legs, right? And it grabs me by the throat and it throws me down on the bar and it pulls itself down my throat. Drink me, and I'm yelling the whole time, stop it, I'm an alcoholic. Ah! I have no connection with drinking against my own will. I don't know what that looks like, because here's what the phenomenon of craving appears like to me in my life. I have burned my life to the ground, and I swear to you and everybody around you, and I swear to myself, and I mean it, I really mean it, that I'm never going to drink that again, ever. I'm not going to do it, ever. I will not do it. Then, the uncomfortability of abstinence from alcohol drives me to tell myself the first lie. The first lie is, you know what, you're not going to drink like you did last time or the time before. Here's what you're going to do, Sheldon. You're going to have one, maybe two. Three at the most, no more than four, but you are not going to drink the way you did. You're not going to do it. And I mean it, and you put me on a lie detector, and I am not going to do that. And I have one, maybe two. I have that third or fourth drink, and then the phenomenon of craving magically appears in my life like this. I change my mind. I change my mind. It feels like I'm the one that changed it. My mind changed, I changed it, I changed my mind. You know what? Screw it. You know what? Really? Who cares? I was looking for a job when I found that one, right? I don't need those people. Who are those people? You know what? Sometimes, just right out of the book, sometimes I don't even think at all. I just say, Bart, keep them coming. Because something happens to me somewhere in that weird gap between getting relief and getting slammed where I just change. It looks like a good idea. It looks like a good idea. And I do it over and over and over and over again. And I swear I'm never going to drink again. I come back to AA and I say, please help me. And here's what happens, is that you guys, you good people, you wonderful people at Alcoholics Anonymous, say things to me that I don't understand. You tell somebody in AA, maybe it's not like this in Cayman, it's like this in Vegas. You tell somebody in Vegas that you're struggling staying sober, and you can't stay sober because, oh my God, it's just impossible, and they will say to you, you know, when I was new like you, I didn't worry about all that. I just stayed sober one day at a time. Just stay sober one day at a time. Which sounds like it makes sense unless you feel like I feel. Because in a state of abstinence, I feel lonely, anxious, uncomfortable, uptight, wound up. I feel on edge. I just feel, I don't feel good. And when you say stay sober one day at a time, what I hear you say, one of the things I hear you say is, that if you will come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you will do this thing with everything that is in you one day at a time, you'll get to stay sober feeling like you're feeling now for the rest of your life one day at a time. It sounds like a prison sentence to me, right? It sounds like if you do Alcoholics Anonymous with a fervor, you will stay sober one day at a time. One long, miserable, painful day at a time. Some guy says that he's sober, you know, 20 years, and I think to myself, you Paul bastard. Oh my God, could you imagine 20 years of feeling like I feel one day sober forever? Because I have no perception of what it might feel like to be an active everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous, having worked the steps under the guidance of a sponsor, sponsoring guys, actively involved in my home group, having made my amends, having been an everyday participant, as well, not every day, that's a lie, but as much as I can discipline myself to be an everyday participant in steps 10 and 11, but an active everyday member of AA, I don't know what that feels like. I think what you offer me is a way to stay miserable without drinking one day at a time. I have no idea of the blessings that are available in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I tell you, I can't do it. I can't stay sober one day at a time. And what do you say? If you can't stay sober one day at a time, Sheldon, do it 1 hour, 60 painful minutes. You can see the second hand, tick, 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 right? It's agony. You offer agony. But I don't know what to do. And so I get drunk. And then I get sober, and then I get drunk, and then I get sober, and then I get drunk, and I don't know what to do. On July 4th of 1996, I was living in Vegas, and I went back down to Southern California to party with some friends. It was an island of hope. It was this idea that I'd be able to recapture my youth with the friends of my youth, partying like I did in my youth. It's July 4th. We'll get up. There's a state park in Southern Orange County, Doheny State Park, where you can camp for July 4th, and they set the fireworks on the barges. I'm sure you have parks like that here. They're going to say, we just party. And we do everything. And I'm a pig. I have alcoholism and it's my only disease. But I tell you, you shouldn't put anything else near me because I am not a specialist. Right? I am not. And I will take it, drink it, smoke it, eat it. I don't care. And I did all of it. I did everything from alcohol to acid, coke. I mean, we went off. And after the fireworks that night and after the party wound down, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, I'm laying in the back of this Ford Escort that I was driving. It's a station wagon style hatchback. I'm looking up at the sky, and something happened that had happened many times before, but that I had a conversation with myself about. And that was that even though I was physically inebriated, I was mentally awake. And I'd been that way many, many times before, but it was this moment that I remember. I'm sure there'd been similar conversations, but I remember this one. The party's over. I'm going to continue to pay the price. and I'm not going to get to fly free no more. I'm going to continue to pay the price, and I'm not going to get the relief I'm seeking. I'm going to continue to pay the price, and the best it's going to get is sloppy and depressed. And I'm going to continue to pay the price. And I've been going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous at that point for 2 years. And I couldn't stop, and AA couldn't help me. And I've been fantasizing about slamming my car into the abutment of the highway. I've been fantasizing for about 6-8 months what it would be like if I could only kill myself. I didn't know how. I didn't know how because on top of everything else about me that is true, and there's a lot of dirty things about me. I have dirty secrets about what a scumbag I am. But on top of all of them, the underlying truth is that on top of all of it, I'm a coward. I'm like Wilson. I'm stood in front of the medicine cabinet, staring at the poison, cursing myself because I can't take it. I get back to Vegas, and I'm begging a God I don't believe in. I don't believe in God. And I'm begging a God I don't believe in. Let me die in my sleep. But I keep waking up. And I keep waking up. On July 16th of 1996, I went to bed and I prayed harder than I ever prayed before to not let me wake up that morning. God, if you have any mercy, take me in my sleep. On July 17th, I woke up. July 17th of 1996, I woke up and I was mad. And I'm laying in my bed and I'm yelling at God. I'm yelling at God because it's forsaking me because it's going to make me live another day. And I heard a voice. And I tell you, it was probably lack of sleep. It was probably some bad fish I'd eaten the night before. It was probably some weird mental I'd like to believe it was the voice of God because I don't hear the voice of God. I believe in my delusional fantasy-filled mind. I've heard his voice twice. This was one of them. I may never have, but to me it was real. And the voice said this. Go back to AA. Go back to AA. Do what they tell you. I get tingles thinking about it. And I went back to AA. And I went and sat in that room and I had nothing to say. I had no opinion. I'd had an opinion every other time I'd showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous about who you were and the truths you were telling and the lies you were telling and what I thought you should have me do and what kind of people you really were and if you were like me and if you drank like me or you didn't drink like me, but I had no opinion. I went and sat in that room. And people would share and I would cry. They'd say things that really, you know, physically weren't related to me, but I'd get a sense of their emotions and they'd trigger me and I'd cry. About 4 days later, a guy walked in the room. It was a noon meeting. This guy never came to that meeting. God will use everything about you once he's decided or you've offered yourself. He'll always accept you to be one of his agents. This guy was at that noon meeting chasing a girl. He walked in that meeting, he sat down, and they called on him to share. And he started to talk about his drinking, yes. Identify enough to know that he drank to make a mess. But then he started to talk about his loneliness and his anxious separation and what it felt like in the times that he quite tried to stay sober. And I knew that he knew. I knew that he knew my big secret. My big secret is drinking is not my problem. Yes, it makes a mess, and no, I can't stop. But it's not really the problem. It's the solution that quit working. And the problem really is how I feel in a state of abstinence. But I can't tell you that, so what do I say? How am I? I'm fine. 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 How are you? You're fine? I'm fine. Fine. I'm glad you're fine. 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 Leave me alone. Fine. But he knew. He knew the thing I didn't want anyone to know, which was that I had a secret, and the secret was, in a state of abstinence, I wasn't worth nothing. Nothing. And after the meeting, I went up to him, and I talked to him, and I told him I needed his help. And he told me he was my sponsor. And I talked to him about that just last week. He never does that. Some guys volunteer themselves to be... He said that he cannot remember one other occasion when he did that. I'm glad he did it for me because to me, it's like asking a girl to dance at the prom. I don't have it in me. 20 years sober, I don't have it in me. I could never have asked him to be my sponsor. I am too insecure, too afraid, too low opinion of myself. He said, I'm your sponsor. That day he took me to a detox meeting. I was sober 4 days, less than most of the clients. He took me there and he told me I would go to detox meetings, jails, or halfway houses for the rest of my sobriety if I wanted to live a useful, happy life. That night we went to a Big Book meeting at his house. He told me I'd go to Big Book meetings on a regular basis if I wanted to have a useful, happy life. I would take other guys through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me these are the things that I had to do. And he's been my sponsor ever since. I've only had one sponsor in this go-around of sobriety. He's been my sponsor ever since. I owe that man my life. And every time I say that, it makes him uncomfortable. He says, no, no, no. It's God and the steps in the program and the process of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I go, yeah, I know. That's what I tell my guys too. But that man saved my life. He started me on a journey through the steps out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we started to talk about step one. And step one was an interesting conversation because we want to talk about two things. We want to talk about powerless over alcohol and life is unmanageable. And I've wasted a lot of time talking to new people in Alcoholics Anonymous about the unmanageability that I would talk to a longer timer about the unmanageability. You talk to me about the unmanageability, the way that when I'm new, the way that you might now, you're going to lose me because I've never thrown a sober breath. So he made it real simple. He says to me, Sheldon, are you powerless over alcohol? Does booze cause you problems? I said, yeah, it's a mess. Can you stop? No. Have you ever tried to stop? Yes. Yes, I've tried to stop. You ever been sober and drink again? I mean, okay, about 3 years. I got average of 10 days. I mean, I got 30 days once and I lied about 60 days twice, right? But I'm not a stay sober for very long kind of guy, right? So I'm about 10 days between drinks. Sometimes I leave the meeting at the break and get drunk. Sometimes I stay sober 10 days. Sometimes I get there, but on average, it's probably about every 10 days is about how long my fuse is. I'll drink at the 10-day mark. 3 years, 365 days a year, about 30 times every 10 days per year I drink, about 3 years, about 100. About 100 times I've sat in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and said, I'm a newcomer and I never want to drink again, and I drank again afterwards. He said, that, to me, sounds like you're powerless over alcohol. Sounds pretty powerless. What do you think? You ever do this? You ever look to see what each one of your relapses, and he laughed when he said it, because I'm not really, you can't relapse from something you never had. But these times when you went back and drank again, you ever notice what they have in common? Do any of them have anything in common? What do you mean? Well, like last time you drank, why did you drink? Why did I drink last time I drank? I drank because I lost my job. My boss said SOB, he fired me, I quit, I don't remember which one it was, but I left and I went and got drunk. He goes, great. Every time you got drunk after a period of sobriety, every time you got drunk, was it because you got fired? No. Well, how about the time before that? Why did you think the time before? Got rejected by a girl. Every time you drank, was it because you got rejected by a girl? Well, more times than I want to admit from the podium. But not every time. Not every time. He said, what did each one of those drunks have in common? I don't know. It's a trick question. He said, no. He said, I know. I know. He said, what is it? He said, every single time you took a drink after a period of abstinence, you were as physically sober as you are right now. With a sober and sane mind, you decided beverage alcohol would be a good move for your future. That sounds pretty unmanageable to me. I mean, whoever's making the long-term decisions for your life should be shot, right? And you don't have the balls to shoot him because you've been thinking about it for a while. Let's just fire him and move on. Let's just get someone. You're okay. Then he says, what about God? Look at that second step, right? I can't do God. I can't come to believe in nothing. And I can't do step three. I can't turn my will and my life over to nothing either. Why? Well, I told you I grew up in a Jewish home. That's not strictly true. I grew up in an atheist Jewish home. Now, right? Now what that means is that we're Jews but we know we're wrong. The only people on the planet that are more wrong than us are our crazy Christian neighbors. Now, some of you laughed at the Jewish joke and looked angry at the Christian joke. You should call your sponsors immediately. You have work to do. But I would go to my mom, and we'd be talking, and she would be like, "Well, tell me about religion." And she would say, "Religion is the opiate of the masses. It's for fools and children. Now get dressed, we're going to temple." And we were two block Jews, is the sect of Judaism we belong to. Two block Jews. Let me explain what I mean. In my sect of Judaism, actually, you can't drive on the Shabbat. On Saturday, you're not allowed to drive at all. Have to walk to temple. Gotta walk. Temples don't even have parking lots. Gotta walk there. Gotta walk to temple. Now, because of the sprawl of the community, the temple is 5 miles from where everybody lives. So the good Jews are up Saturday morning dressed in their temple best, and they're walking 5 miles to temple. We would take the bus around the corner, look tired, and walk the last two blocks because we were two-block Jews. And I can't do the Jewish faith. It does nothing for me. I can't connect to it. I couldn't plug into it. When I get here, you tell me that I got to believe in God, and I can't do the God of my childhood, and I can't do your God either. Imagine for a minute, you know, you grew up in a relatively Christian country, and imagine for a minute that now you go and you're going to try and get sober in a Muslim country. And you think that they're telling you, in order to get sober, you have to become a Muslim. It might be impossible for you, as it was for me to become a Christian growing up in a Jewish home, even though I didn't have any Jewish faith. I got a lot of resentments against the Jewish community. I tell my sponsor, can't do step two, can't do step three, I guess I'm gonna die. And he said, let's look at the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, let's look at the big book. So they always say that, let's look at the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's see, have you read what's in the book? You know what that means? When your sponsor says, what does the book say? You know what that means? They have no idea how to answer your question. They just want you to go read something and leave them alone, right? But he gets the book out and he opens the book to page 47. And on page 47, he says, this is step two. This is all of step two. There's no more to step two than this. Let's read this sentence. Okay, he says. He says, I'm supposed to ask you just one short question. Do you now believe it? And I said, stop. I do not believe. I don't believe in God. No, I don't believe in God. I do not believe. Do not believe in God? No. He goes, I get it. You don't believe in God? Right, I don't believe in God. He said, good, it's a comma, not a period. Can we read the rest of the sentence? Do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe, in a power greater than yourself? What does that mean? It means, do you believe? I know you don't believe, but are you willing to believe that maybe, perhaps, there might be a God, maybe? It's unlikely. I doubt it. There probably isn't one. I mean, I know, like, if you want me to commit right now, the answer is no, but do you think that maybe it's possible? Maybe, there might be a God, maybe, unlikely. Don't believe, but maybe perhaps. I mean, let's just say, for example, that it's unlikely as it is, that maybe might be a God, perhaps, maybe, no, yes, maybe. I mean, I'm not really willing to commit. You don't have to commit. Do you think that maybe there might possibly, perhaps, be a God? Maybe. But even an idiot like me can say yes to a question like that. And what does the book say next? It says, as soon as a man can say that he either does believe, which I didn't, or is even willing to believe in a power greater than himself, we emphatically assure him he's on his way. Emphatically, like, yeah, baby, you're done. Step two in the bag. In fact, if you can, now don't let your sponsor know I said this, but if you walked in here tonight working on step two, we just did it together. It's over. You're done. Move on. I said, so what do I do now? He said, what do you do now? I said, say the prayer. Say the prayer. Say the prayer. Just say the prayer. I'll say the prayer. Say the prayer. You're done with three. You said the prayer. Said the prayer. We're done with three. Now write the list. Write the list. Write the list. Share the list. Write the list and share the list. Do four and five. Write the list, share the list. Write the list, share the list. Don't worry about six and seven. Nobody understands six and seven, doesn't it? worry about 6 and 7. Nobody has a clue what 6 and 7 is. Just doesn't matter. Does not matter. 8 and 9? I said, what about 8 and 9? 8 and 9, they want my money. He said, no, they don't. In 8 and 9, they do not want your money. They want their money. But if you're not willing to do it, you don't have to. Don't worry about it. 10 and 11 are my two favorite steps because I tell you, most people, half the people in AA, think they're doing 10 when they're really doing 11. Yeah. Some of you look confused. Some of you are nodding. Nodding people, get with the confused people. Confused people, get with the nodding people. Let's clear this up once and for all. But who cares? And then help people. Just help people. Do the process. Do it. If you had to believe in God to do step 2 or step 3, why would you do that? I mean, seriously, right? I mean, listen, my sponsor says to me, Sheldon, do this. Go out into the AA group and find the people that you love and respect and ask them why they're so, why are you sober? Ask them, why are you sober? I know what they're going to say. You hand it out on cards at the break, right? If a newcomer says to you, how are you sober? You say this, I am sober today because of a loving God that I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank God for AA. And I'd like to thank AA for God. Right? Right? That's what we all say. It's like they hand it on the card. I know what to say. I know what I'm sober today because of my loving God. Thank God. Now, I don't mean to goof on that because I got to tell you that I am, in all honesty, sober today. Right? Because of a loving God, right? That I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I'm sober. And if I get to meet God, right, I get up there and I get an audience with a big guy, I'm going to go, Pops, a couple things. Right, Doug the Duck Bill Platypus, right? Just have to say that. That was odd. But while I got your attention, thanks for AA. Because that rocked it. I mean, that was I don't know how you did it, but you changed, saved, metamorphosized, you blew my life away with that AA thing, Pops. I dig it. I would tell him that, right? But I come back to my sponsor and I say, it's all because they found God. And he says to me, well, let me ask you. Chubby, if you could find God in step 3, I mean, really find God in a meaningful way in step 3. Like, connect with God in step 3 in a way that's going to let you stay sober one day at a time, happily, usefully, oh, for the rest of your life. If you could do that in step 3, why the hell would you do step 4? Seriously, it sucks. Right? 5, embarrassing. I mean, really? Why would you do any of the steps? Our 12 steps is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Take the steps, get the awakening. Take the steps, get the awakening. Maybe you already have an awakening of some kind. You've never done the steps. Great. Not the kind we're talking about here. Powerful, beautiful, wonderful. Just the wrong one. Have 2 awakenings. Have the one you already have, right? And then have ours too. Because it'll help you stay sober, and that's what we're trying to do here, right? You can have as many awakenings. You can have multiple awakenings. You thought I was going to say something else, didn't you? Look at your face like, don't go there. you can have multiple awakenings. You gotta have our kind of awakening. So Shoemaker, right? Some of you guys know who Shoemaker was. He wrote a thing in A Comes of Age about the scientific method, the scientific approach of Alcoholics Anonymous, about the magic of the scientific approach, the steps and that Alcoholics Anonymous puts on us for spirituality. And here's what he's talking about, and it's beautiful. And some of you guys might be scientists. I flunked out. Listen, if I'm wrong about this, I apologize. But the scientific method, right? What is the scientific method? The scientific method, you come up with an idea that you believe, you don't even know if you believe it. It's an idea that you want to prove true or false. You come up with a theory, right? You come up with a theory, and you set your theory in motion, and you create a test to see whether or not the theory is true. And you have no preconceived idea about whether or not what result the theory should give. You just take the action. And you run the test, you run the experiment, and at the end of the experiment you judge the results, and then you know whether or not the theory was true. And this is the scientific approach to spirituality. My sponsor says, what you have to do is you have to act as if God exists. You have to just act as if God exists. Pray to God, write the inventories, do the work in AA, make the amends, help newcomers. Take the spiritual action, act as if God exists. Whether you believe he does or he doesn't, just act as if God exists. Wouldn't that make me a hypocrite? Would that be a new thing for you? Would that be something you've never been before? But I'm worried about being a hypocrite. I'm not worried about being a thief, a liar, or a lunatic, but a hypocrite. Oh, right? So just act as if, take the actions as if God exists. Take the actions as if God exists. Act like he exists. Do that for a little while, and we'll see what happens. And in 3 months, we can check your life, see if it's better or worse. If your life's getting better, let's keep running the experiment. We'll check it again in 6 months. We'll check it in a year. We'll check it in a couple of years. We'll periodically check your life. And we don't even care if you've decided to believe in God. We're just going to check your life to see if acting like a guy that believes in God makes your life better. I can do that. I can act the part. You know, like I told you at the very beginning of my talk, my brother says I have no personality of my own whatsoever. I, however, think I'm a chameleon. Somewhere in the middle there is true. And I can tell you any lie you want to know. So let's lie and pretend God exists. Sure, God exists. Let's pretend. And I start acting that way. Now, what does that mean? So I would say to him, what does that mean? He'd say, you kind of know, but let's get you a starter on it. I go get a job. I get a job. It's not a very good job, but it's a job. Get a job. Have a job. All right, I'll have a job. Stop being a mooch. People that believe in God, trust God, they get jobs. They act like they want to be self-supporting because they believe God will take care of them. If they take care of themselves, get a job. Go to work. At that job, be nice to the people that you work for. Be of service. Get there early. Do your job all day long. This is what a guy that believes in God would do. He would act like a good employee. Now, I go to work and I do that. And I got to tell you, I do not instantly believe in God. I do very quickly get a promotion, which kind of helps with the experiment and how's my life doing. Right? I get a promotion. I get another promotion. This is bizarre. I meet a girl. I like this girl. I meet this girl. This girl's willing to go out with me, which is bizarre. For me, that's evidence in the God column, right? That's evidence in the God column. However, right, I don't know what to do. How do I treat this girl? He says, treat this girl like she's one of God's kids. Treat her like you'd want your sister to be treated. Treat her with respect. Treat her with kindness. Do things for her that she'd like to get done. Help her enjoy her life. Don't worry about you, worry about her. God's going to worry about you, you worry about her. Did not immediately believe in God. We are married 20 years, right, with a beautiful kid and a wonderful family. But I started to treat her that way, and I get Evan, my life starts to work. I don't know when I started believing in God. This is the goofiest thing. I've tried to think back through my life to see when I started to believe in God, and I've been unable to pinpoint the moment. I don't know. I do know this. I was about 5 or 6 years sober, and I was driving to my sponsor's book study that he has at his house on a Tuesday night. I'm getting halfway up the hill towards his house, and I just broke apart. I started crying, weeping like a baby. I pull into his driveway, I get out of his car, he opens the door, he goes, oh my God, what is wrong with you? What happened? And I said, nothing. He said, why are you crying? I said, it's true. It's all true. So what are you talking about? He said, there's a God. And he loves me. And it's real. And I've been off the debating team for a while, and I don't know when this became real for me, but it became real for me, and I don't know when. But there is a God in my life, and it's real. And he started laughing. And I realized it had been a while since I'd acted as if God existed. It had been a while since I'd acted better than I felt. You know, one of the things that frustrates me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that sometimes people will talk from the podium, give great talks, but sometimes I will hear something that doesn't line up for me. And it'll be this idea that at 20 years sober, I'm still sick. At 20 years sober with God in my life, I'm still as self-centered and as weird as I was. I'm still as likely to hurt you as I used to be, as if God doesn't really exist and it's a lie. I gotta tell you, I'm not the guy that got sober. I'm a good guy most of the time. You could trust me. You could leave me with your women, children, and money, and I won't mess with none of them. Because God works, and AA works, and we become different people here. And my life is transformed. And I sometimes, when I am afraid, have to act better than I feel. But it used to be that I had to do that all day, every day. I got some stuff going on in my life right now. It's a little scary. Some business stuff that I'm not sure how it's going to work out. And it's big stuff. It's stuff that will affect my family greatly one way or the other. And I'm afraid. And I was laughing with my sponsor. Because when I first got sober, what my life felt like was I was always constantly afraid. Always on the edge, always on the muscle, always full of anxiety. I get sober a little bit and I get moments of serenity. I comprehend the word serenity. Don't have it very often, but I know what the word means. I comprehend the word serenity. I get glimpses, islands of serenity in a sea of fear. And today my life is different. Today I live in a sea of serenity, a sea of trust. I live in a sea of tranquility. And sometimes I have islands of abject terror. Sometimes it washes over me and I don't know what to do. In this business dealing that I'm with, it's funny because sometimes I'll just get like, I need an answer now. And the problem with that is if you need an answer now, the answer now is always no. Right? And I'm going to push for the answer. I'm going to get no. So I get, but I'll get overwhelmed with fear. And I'll breathe through it, and I'll pray through it, and I'll meditate through it, and I'll talk to my sponsor through it, and it will subside. And I'll go back to large stretches of serenity, happiness, and peace. And those flip-flopped in my life, where it used to be small amounts of serenity and large amounts of fear, honestly, my life today is large amounts of serenity and small amounts of fear. Because Alcoholics Anonymous works. And if you're new, I want to tell you, that my experience, and I hope my experience is like your experience, I have a feeling that it will be. That if you will do what I heard a speaker say, and I don't remember who they were, I'd love to give them credit because I love this line. The speaker say, come all the way in and sit all the way down. Not on the edges, not on the outskirts, not a part-time member, not come here sometimes, but really come all the way in. If you'll come all the way in, sit all the way down. Make your life an Alcoholics Anonymous life where it's the center of your existence. If you will do that, Alcoholics Anonymous will change your life in ways that you can't imagine. Drinking will no longer be a problem. If it is, you'll recall from it like a hot flame. It'll be no big deal. You will comprehend the word serenity. You will know peace and you won't fear any of the crap you're afraid of now. It'll kind of fall away. And the bright spot of your life will be contact with each other. You'll get to help new people. You'll get to see the lights come on. You'll get to see them get fired up. You'll get to participate in mothers getting their children back and children getting their parents back and seeing lives in front of you change in miraculous ways. And when it happens, you'll go, you know, I missed it in me. But I know that it happened because I saw it in you. And you'll get fired up and your life will have purpose. And you won't feel that empty, lonely, worthless thing that many of us feel now. Because this journey in Alcoholics Anonymous is a journey that we take together. But it is a private journey. It is a spiritual journey that nobody can tell you how you have to take. You take it alone in a group of people. Together and by yourself. A spiritual journey where hopefully you'll get to get connected with a power greater than yourself that will, check this out, allow you to stay sober one day at a time. Right? I mean, isn't that bizarre, right? That's what happens here. Comfortably, happily, usefully home. I am so grateful that I get to spend my life as an everyday active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful I get to be a member of my home group where I have a little job, where I do stuff to help the meeting operate. I'm grateful that I get to work with new guys and watch the lights come on in their eyes. I'm grateful that I get to share my life with a sponsor that knows the good, the bad, and the ugly about me. I'm glad that I have a sober home. So grateful that I have a sober home and that my employer's not worried. I'm so grateful for all of the everyday activity I get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm also grateful that the cherry on the top is that today I got to come out to Grand Cayman and share your beautiful island with you. Thank you for my life.